Well, hello. It's good to see you again. As you can imagine, it's been a pretty tough couple of weeks. There was no show even available for last week. It is the holidays, and that has part to do with it. I've also had about one day off in the last 2 weeks, so it's been very difficult for me to find time to sit down and work on these interviews, work on these episodes. Both of the interviews that you'll hear in this episode were recorded a couple of weeks ago. I've got actress and singer-songwriter Jill Hennessy. She has a new album coming out called I Do, and as well she's also appearing in the new TV show Madam Secretary. You'll also be hearing from actress Felicia Snoop Pearson. You may know her best as the character of Snoop on The Wire. And she's in the new Spike Lee joint called Chi-Raq. So we'll be talking to her about that. I must say, I did get a chance to see the new Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens. As you know, I had Star Wars expert and fanatic David Christopher on a couple weeks ago. Before the movie came out, I've had a chance to see it now. It was very, very good. I did enjoy it. Been talking amongst my nerd friends. There's a few canon issues that they have. It was funny. My friend and I, when we saw it, after the theater was empty, we sat there and debated amongst the two of us about whether or not the film passes the Bechdel test. For those of you who don't know, the Bechdel test is a test that was created. Basically, it has to have two female characters talking to each other about something other than a man for more than a minute. And there's debate online about whether or not it actually passes the test, but we seem to think it does, which is a very, very good sign, and I'm really impressed with JJ's handling of all the female characters, from Leia to Rey to Maz Kamada, as well as all the other characters as well. But no spoilers, I will not do that, so I will move on. As I mentioned, my first guest is actress and singer-songwriter Jill Hennessy. Her new album is I Do. I've been super excited for this interview for a while. I had Jill on my show about 4 years ago, and it's still one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done. Jill is so personable, so upbeat, and such a great, great conversation that our talk stretched into about a half an hour, so we're going to be breaking it up for you into two chunks. But first, we're going to start with the title track off her new album, I Do. So fast. Well, my first guest is a Canadian actress who has been thrilling audiences in North America for over 25 years. She made her film debut as an escort in the Jeremy Irons thriller Dead Ringer, in which her twin sister Jacqueline also appeared. She made her stage debut a couple years later in the musical The Buddy Holly Story. Perhaps audiences know her best in her role as ADA Claire Kincaid on Law and Order from 1995 to 1997. She followed that up a few years later with the title role on the fabulous series Crossing Jordan. She has appeared in other films such as Wild Hogs with Tim Allen, William H. Macy, and Martin Lawrence, and Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town, CBC's ode to Stephen Leacock. She is currently appearing in the CBS show Madam Secretary opposite Taya Leone, but she also happens to be a singer-songwriter. Her second album, I Do, was released a couple of months ago, and I got a chance to have a lovely conversation on the phone with her. Here is my chat with Canadian great Jill Hennessy. I am joined on the phone by actress, singer-songwriter Jill Hennessy. Jill, hello. Welcome back, I should say.
Wow, well, thanks for having me back. I'm shocked you would have me back after last time.
It's been.
We won't discuss that, though, right?
It's yeah, I know. It's, well, you know, four years ago. It's in the past. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be better this time, man. I promise.
I remember last time I had you on. God, that was 4 years ago, November 2011. And even back then, you were talking about your second album, and you were almost ready to do it then. So what happened? Why did it take so long?
Well, you're right. Most of the songs, you know, were finished by then. We'd almost completed recording at that point. And we were just looking for a good time to release the album. And I kept getting, you know, various jobs. Some were in Canada, some were in the States, you know, various acting jobs. So we finally settled on this date of, you know, October 5th of 2015, just thinking, oh, we're free, we're in the clear. And we can, you know, also we got two kids, so we're basically our own little mom and pop kind of label where everything we do, including all the digital store and the website and all distribution stuff, you know, our nerve center is our kitchen table, man, and it's usually covered in kids' food and homework, and it's insanity. So, of course, we decided to drop the album I Do October 5th of this year, and then I get this job on Madam Secretary, which is a CBS show here in the States. And so that was interesting. So, hey, I guess you just have to go for it. We should have just released it anyway.
But
it's been going well.
You mentioned your kids, and I read that for this album you actually took a lot of inspiration from them, especially from your older son, in terms of what should go on the album.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, good job, by the way. Yeah, in fact, one of the tracks is heavily based on an experience my older son had at a school dance, which floored me. And I can't even talk about it. I get a little verklempt. It's crazy. Anyway, but I had to go home and write this song. So he became sort of the foundation of Precious One. And that there's little edge elements of Amy Winehouse in that song, and other people sort of being waylaid and dealt these heavy blows by, I guess, critical words or prejudices of other people. And then that was around the time, I think, that Amy passed away. And she sort of edged in when I started thinking about all the wonderful, incredible artistic people we've lost to things like drug addiction. And so she's part of that one. So is my older son.
What kind of music would you say your kids have exposed you to over the last few years?
That's interesting. Man, it's funny because my older son is really retro. I mean, he's heavily into Zeppelin, but he mixes Zeppelin with like Jay-Z, with Macklemore, and then he loves Eminem too. I'm like, dude, you're going way back, bro. But then I got him into The Weeknd.
Nice.
I'm like, you gotta listen to some Canadian music, bro. he loves Drake. My younger son is much more pop oriented. I mean, he's deep into, actually he's really into the new Sam Smith track off the Spectre movie, Writings on the Wall. And they both love Adele. But I guess what my older son really reminded me of, he really brought me back to Radiohead, which has always been one of my favorite bands anyway. But he just sort of made me revisit all these bands, like Zeppelin, like Radiohead, and look at some of the melodic structures and just what makes those songs so anthemic, you know, so epic. So I'd like to say I could build all my songs like that. That would be great. But it really does sort of resonate, you know, when you're writing and performing. I think about that stuff.
I had to listen to a few of the tracks off the album. What struck me, especially with something like the title track I Do, is that it seems a little more, perhaps maybe upbeat and a little more rock based compared to the previous album. Would you agree with that? And was that a conscious decision for you?
Dan, that was very conscious, actually, and you hit it. You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly how I kind of went into the second album. I was thinking, you know what? I gotta be more upbeat. I think I've got to lighten things up a wee tad. This album really is sort of, the next footprint in the sand after Ghost in My Head, which was sort of about my childhood and very autobiographical. And this one, I did want to lighten up. I wanted to. It's also about, you know, life after, you know, childhood. And I did want to focus more on more rock rhythms. I wanted the whole album to focus more on rhythms, on bass and drums and rhythm lines. And also, yeah, more pace, more sense of melodic lightness. And a little more on harder edges, you know, and that's why we got a friend of ours named Sean Bevan, who worked with Marilyn Manson and Guns N' Roses. He mixed the album, and that was one of the directives I gave him was, you know, dude, go for the hard edge. Go, you know, if you got a choice when you're mixing this, bro, just go for the harder edge. So you were very astute in feeling that way, by the way.
Speaking of Edge, one of the songs that I really like, I think just in terms of how it sounds, because I feel it's maybe a little bit different than the other things on the album, is Something's Coming. What can you tell us about that song?
Okay, yeah, well, that was that interesting you bring that one up, because the real focus on that one was groove, was rhythm. And I did want to make something that was a little more hooky. You know, they had something where you'd listen to it once and just walk away humming that groove feeling and wanting to move. And that one is a combination of... I recorded that, the demo for that, actually, in Sean's garage. I guess when I first recorded that demo, I said, look, bro, I'm kind of looking for this sort of New Orleans swamp funeral procession vibe, you know, sort of a dark tone under this pulsating groove, sort of a blues, R&B, gospel kind of thing, little edges there and here and there. And that one was just, I didn't want to make it so specific. I wanted it to be more general in terms of the lyrics. And yet positive, like something, how can I say, it's so easy to be dark about so much of the stuff that's going on that you read in the news, that you see in front of your face in the streets every day. And just wanting to believe that something better is coming, that we can, if we actually just open our eyes and look at whatever pain our neighbor's going through, our friends or somebody on the street is going through, maybe we can actually help each other. I don't know. It was me trying to be very positive. And I ended up writing this really dark, swampy song. But that's sort of what the lyrical intent was.
We alluded there to Ghosts in My Head, which was your first album. And if there's one song on I Do that reminds me of Ghosts in My Head, I think it has to be Edmonton.
Okay.
And in true Canadian style, you wrote a song about a city and specifically your hometown. What was the inspiration for doing that?
Good question, man. I had wanted to write a song about my grandmother Anne for some time, and I was born in Edmonton, but I never really lived there. My twin sister and I were 3 months old when my parents moved. I think we moved to Calgary. Cranbrook, B.C., and then Calgary after that. And as children, we moved every 2 years, so we were uprooted quite a bit. But my grandmother, we'd go visit her during the holidays a lot, and she was just this force to be reckoned with. She was Ukrainian. She was incredibly powerful. I remember her being this huge, strong woman, and she was definitely the ruler of the household. And we'd get up at 5 in the morning to make pierogies, and sometimes I'd go and help her roll out the dough and spoon in the fillings and stuff and pinch the edges. And I have just really fond memories about her, but also as an adult, recollecting some of the stories she told us about her childhood and things that happened to her as a Ukrainian-speaking 12-year-old being put into kindergarten, and the anti-Ukrainian sentiment that was very prevalent at that time when she was a little girl. And what she went through as an immigrant, even though it was her parents who emigrated to Canada, but she was raised in a Ukrainian-speaking farming camp south of Edmonton. So when she was 12, they moved to Edmonton, and she was put in the public school system. But she, some kid called her a very negative name, a derogatory term that was used towards Ukrainians at the time, and she threw a rock at this kid, and she was thrown out of school, and I don't think she ever went back. And she later went on to, you know, various jobs, cooking for lumber camps or farming camps. And so for years I thought, I've got to write a song about Grandma Anne. And then I got a spot at the Edmonton Folk Festival. Gosh, I guess that was like 4 years ago. And I thought, okay, I've just got to, you know, put pen to paper and write about Grandma Anne. And so I did, and that's what came of that, the song Edmonton.
She brought a glass teacup, red as gypsy's blood, to a place where her shadows might just fade away. But the kids called her names for not talking the same, and the school sent her home for throwing that stone at a boy speaking hate he could not, should not understand. Never talked about religion, never said too much about her past. Why such a young, pretty girl learn how to run so fast? Take a trip across the water, find us a world with something better. I can't tell you, my sweet child, why we've gotta run all the way to Edmonton. Not secrets, go to work till the sun sets, knowing anything's better together here than what we left behind. When she met her young husband, had three lovely children, she cooked like her mother, so safe in the kitchen, while Harry sits with his bottle.
Given what you just told me about your grandma and her immigrant history, what do you make of the current dialogue and discussion that's being had both in the U.S. and here in Canada about the immigration issue?
Yeah, and obviously it's a very hot button issue all over the world now, especially with the crisis in the Middle East and such. The first thing that comes to my mind is I was so excited to see Prime Minister Trudeau and his reception of Syrian refugees recently, and just the way he shook people's hands and said "Welcome home." I don't know. It gave me chills, and I was so thrilled and warmed to the core to see that. And it's interesting that as human beings, I think we're all immigrants. I mean, unless you're you know, Native Canadian, Native American. I mean, you know, we've all at some point come from somewhere else, and our ancestors were either trying to escape something, or they were brought here in chains, or they came here with nothing, or they came with privilege. You know, it takes so much courage to take a chance and risk everything to start a new life and jump into a place that you know nothing about, where you probably don't speak the language, where your skin color might not be the same as everybody else's. I'm kind of blown away by that kind of courage. And that's kind of why I really wanted to write that song, too. And I even wrote the rhythm line, the melody, as a pub song, so people could, like, raise a glass of beer and sort of wave it in the air, but as an homage to the courage it takes to basically leave everything that you're comfortable with, that you've known, or maybe that you're terrified of, but also go into the unknown, to create a better life for your family or yourself, for your future generations. That's what truly impresses me. So.
And you know, on that note, you mentioned that you moved around a lot as a child, and I'm curious, you know, how that affected you at the time, and where you think that led you, and how that inspired you creatively.
Good question. You know, it's funny, as a kid, you know, I remember, like, the fourth time we moved, being very upset, you know, when my mother told me, okay, we're going to move again. And I said, no, we can't. We already moved four times. I remember at the age of eight saying that to my mom. And, you know, in the moment, you know, it's frustrating, and you never get that core group of friends that, you know, a lot of people talk about having, like, oh, I'm seeing my high school friends. I'm seeing my friends from elementary school. And I've never really had that. And yet, one thing I have discovered, living in nine different cities across Canada, is how wonderful it was to get to know so many different cultures, so many different beautiful, sublime parts of Canada, each with its own, you know, distinguishing characteristics. And, you know, going to the beach in Vancouver on Sundays to watch the, you know, the orcas swimming with a big box of donuts. You know, I looked forward to that every week. Or you know, whether it was Calgary and watching the Stampede, and meeting people and learning how to adapt, or learning how to be an empathetic human being, learning how to listen. So I think I learned a lot of those traits just from traveling so much and meeting such a huge variety of people from different backgrounds.
You mentioned off the top that you're shooting Madam Secretary now, and you alluded to politics there earlier, and what once again you're sort of playing a character that's related to politics in some way. You know, you had Claire in Law and Order, and now you have your defense intelligence character here in Madam Secretary. What first attracted you to this role? I know I read that you said you were a disciple of Teo Leoni.
That was what? I'm sorry?
I think I read an article where it quoted you as saying you were a disciple of Teo Leoni.
Definitely. I've adored her from afar for many years, and I actually had the fortune of working with her on a comedy series she did years ago, called Flying Blind. It was one of the first jobs I ever got. It was a half-hour sitcom. And so I got to work with her on a sitcom, which was great. And I just remember her being one of the most beautiful women I'd ever seen, and it being so just really cool and down-to-earth on set. And I followed her career, you know, since then. And then I was offered this. And was, you know, thrilled to be working on the same show with her. I actually worked mainly with Tim Daly's character, who plays her husband on the show. But it's fascinating, because I love watching political drama. To be honest, I mainly watch the news. I really watch things that are scripted, and I get a little nervous about watching anything that I'm in. But it's fascinating to see how these people structure these shows, and it's always weird to play characters whose political beliefs you might be at odds with. But that's kind of what's amazing about acting and challenging about it at the same time. That you basically take on these completely different POVs, and you just go for it. You jump off a cliff.
But on that note, do you think that acting is inherently a political profession? Because
interesting.
Because
I think to some extent, it's interesting you ask that question. I would assume you'd have to be rather adept at acting to be a good politician. I could be wrong. This is an assumption I'm making. But I can't help but think that it would help. I think there's a lot of similarities there.
Now, of course, you're on a show and you're on and you've got an album out. How do you go about balancing the two mediums in which you work in?
It comes down to scheduling. Because one doesn't take away from the other unless there's a scheduling conflict. And what's great about Madam Secretary too is that I'm a recurring character, so basically they give me a month's notice about the times they might need me. I look at my schedule. For example, in January I'm doing a whole bunch of shows. I think I've got 7 shows. So at least I can go back to them and say, okay, well, I'm booked this date, and they'll try to arrange a schedule to make it work with me, and then it's a bit of juggling, but it's totally manageable and kind of exciting. And the executive producer of Madam Secretary is a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and she's actually a singer-songwriter herself, which is interesting, and I did not know that when I got the part. So she's great. I mean, she gets it. She's a brilliant writer. I love that we have sort of similar taste in music, so that helps.
You just picked up on something, Bruce Springsteen, and I just recently saw a clip of you on YouTube playing a Springsteen song. I think it was for the concert for Hurricane Sandy or something like that.
Oh, it was No Surrender at the Strand Theater.
Yes.
Yeah, where I referenced because I did do a concert for Hurricane Sandy relief in Seabright, New Jersey, and where I also played No Surrender. So I was referencing that concert before that that show too. But I love that song, man, and it always feels so relevant and appropriate,
What
is inspirational?
Why do you think there are so many actors and so many singers and songwriters who are adept at crossing over into the other medium?
Why do I think that? I think both singing, songwriting, acting. It's all about telling a story, I think. And I think the more personal you make it, the more universal it's going to be, or universally tangible and relatable. So in a sense, I think it's all, like when people say, what do you like better, acting or singing or songwriting? It's weird. I don't really separate the two in some ways. Like with my singing and songwriting, I get to write my own material, which is great, but oftentimes I'm covering other people's material, which is just like acting other people's words. So in a sense, you're always personalizing it. And it's, I think from the dawn of time, human beings have always loved to tell and to listen to a great story.
On that note, you mentioned that one of your first jobs was with Taya on the sitcom, mm-hmm. But I happen to know that you actually used your singing, if I'm correct, to get one of your very, very first jobs, and I'm curious how you think your life would be different if you never went to New York to audition for Buddy Holly.
Yeah, good question, man. I think it would be very different. You know what? I might not have come to New York. It was literally that show, the Buddy Holly story, that took me from Toronto to San Francisco and then to New York. And that's where I subsequently found my first agent, or first American agent, and started getting, that's when I got Law and Order. So I think things would have been very, very different. I'm not even sure, what I would have done. I might have actually gone to U of T, you know, to study journalism or fine arts. I'm not even sure. But at that point, things sort of started to get pushed by this wave that kept going and going and going. And now I'm speaking to you from my apartment in New York City. Pretty bizarre.
I read, I think I saw that you said you had, what, like something like 7 shows coming up next year. But I read that are you involved in a couple movies coming up? I think I read that, The Other and Confidential.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure when those are even scheduled for release, but those are 2 independent films I shot last year. And another 2 reasons to delay the release of the album as well. so I'm not sure when they're coming out, but yeah, we've got, I guess, 7, you know, music performances through January and February. I guess that'd be 9. But I'm opening for the Indigo Girls at the end of January, which I'm so psyched about. And then we're playing this Light of Day festival that Bruce Springsteen usually headlines, which Michael J. Fox's foundation organized basically to raise money for research into Parkinson's disease and nervous system disorders. And they've got this huge amount of, like, amazing acts scheduled. I think it's like 50 bands playing in a week. So I'm just psyched to hang out. I mean, hang out in the musician's tent, like, hey, how's it going? Do you have any extra guitar picks? Oh, I'm a big fan, you know. Create some bizarre conversation with musicians I adore from afar.
How does it feel to play with the Indigo Girls again? Because I know you used to do it when you were younger. I had a chance to speak with Amy Ray a couple years ago, and I found her just delightful.
Oh, isn't she great? They're both awesome, Amy and Emily. And they really make a point of reaching out and supporting other artists, new artists, you know, friends of theirs, friends and not friends. I mean, people, anybody that they relate to. And they're just incredibly generous human beings and so incredibly talented. But yeah, I opened for them, gosh, I guess that was like around 4 years ago too, when I met them at Mountain Stage. And I was introduced to them. They were the headlining act at Mountain Stage in West Virginia. And I'd mentioned that I had sung a lot of their music on the streets of Toronto and New York. And they said, oh, would you want to come up and sing the encore? We're thinking of doing Closer to Fine and Galileo. And I said, I just happened to know those. And so that's what started that. And then they called me up to mention that they were going to play in New Jersey in a couple venues. And would I want to, you know, come up and sing an encore? And I said, yeah, of course. So I sang with them a few times out in Jersey as well. So we're going to do it again on this tour.
No, I wasn't sure if it was when you were singing those songs, but I read years ago, and I don't know if this is just internet rumor, but for a while you had a reputation of performing barefoot on stage?
Yeah, when I was performing with a band here in New York called the New Originals. Yes, an homage to Spinal Tap there. And the drummer was always playing like either a bongo or a conga drum, and a lot of the venues we tended to play had hollow stages, and I tend to tap my foot quite a bit, and which is how I've always sort of kept rhythm. Or, to be honest, when it's just me playing guitar, I sort of use that as a little percussive element, you know, especially if I'm on something that's kind of hollow, because as a singer songwriter guitarist, you and with no band behind you, you have to sort of fill in for bass and drums. But it was distracting to the drummer. He said, Julie, your boots are too heavy, man. It's making too much noise. I said, oh, I'm sorry. I'll take off. So I would take off my shoes when I perform with these guys.
You mentioned, you know, concerts and venues. Are you going to come to Canada or to Vancouver anytime soon?
I'm hoping to. We've already come up to Toronto a few times since October. But I'm hoping to get out to Vancouver, you know, sooner than later. So hopefully, like after the new year, I would hope for around springtime or something. Because I just miss Vancouver so much, man. And my kids have never seen it, and that kind of bothers me. Like, I'd love to take them to Stanley Park. But Vancouver is such a great music scene. And, you know, the last time I was there, I was working on a Canadian independent film. And,
Yes, that was the...
Kill me, because there were so many great, you know, opportunities and venues to play at. And I've got to get back here ASAP and organize some shows. So I think now's kind of the time. So nothing's on the books yet, but I will let you know.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I believe last time we talked, you had just finished shooting a movie out here in Langley.
Yes, in Langley. Very good.
Yes.
Good memory.
Out of all the songs you have on I Do, if you had to pick a favorite, could you pick one?
It's tough, man. I like so many of them for completely different reasons. Like I usually go to Edmonton because it's kind of emotional for me, and then there's something like Real, which is closer to the end of the disc. It's and there's lines in that I just, some of the lyrics I just love to say. I love the story behind it, and it's sort of nice, you know, singing these songs, because it reminds me of why I was inspired to write them in the first place, and the people that I love and that it inspired me. I feel like I get to make contact with them again just by singing their song, you know. And Marsha G, too, that's about a woman that I really loved, who is a tremendous mother and friend, and who loved to sing with me and helped me out a great deal. And she passed away about 5 years ago, I guess. And again, through singing these songs, I get to sort of make contact with all these people again. So I'm sorry, it's such a rambling answer to your question. Marsha G.
I ask that question all the time, and no artist can, very rarely can they just hone in on one song.
I guess I'll go with Edmonton. Let's say Edmonton.
All right. Well, the album is I Do. I really enjoyed it. I encourage all our listeners to check it out. Jill, I hope we don't wait another 4 years to talk, or another 4 years, or another
I'll
4 years
to. Sooner,
man.
Dan, please, I'll call you.
All right. Or another 4 years for your next album.
I agree.
I Do's out now. Also check out Madam Secretary on CBS.
CBS, I think it's global in Canada.
Yes, I believe you're right on that. Jill, thanks so much. I've been super excited for this interview for a while now.
Oh, by the way, you're amazing, and I don't know, you made me smile. You made me very, very happy today. And
thank you.
Great research, and I'm just thrilled you remember me so well too. That was it's really sweet.
All right. Well, let me know if you ever come to Vancouver.
Will do. Hopefully soon, man. Seriously, I'm not kidding you about that. I miss it. I want my kids to be there.
Hey, well, I'm sure Vancouver misses you too.
Okay, darling. Well, hopefully I'll see you running in Stanley Park.
Alrighty, Jill. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was Jill Hennessy. Her album I Do is out now on iTunes and probably in stores as well, if these things still exist. Be sure also to check her out on Madam Secretary. Check your local listings for exact airtimes. We have another song off her album I Do. This is Something's Coming. My next guest got her start portraying Felicia Snoop Pearson in the iconic TV series The Wire. She has also released a memoir entitled Grace After Midnight and has appeared in a couple of Spike Lee movies, including The Sweet Blood of Jesus and his new film Chi Rack. She also has a great deal many to say about the Baltimore riots and personally knew Freddie Gray, whose death set it all off. She is Felicia Pearson, and I spoke to her a few weeks ago about her role in Chi-Rack.
Edmonton.
I'm joined on the phone by actress Felicia Pearson. Felicia, hello, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you're in the new Spike Lee joint, Chi-Raq. How did you get involved with this project? Did Spike just approach you and say, do you want to be in this?
Yeah, he had called me and asked me my availability, and I said I was available, and I came to Chicago, got my script, and as I got my script, we was reading it over, and I was asking him, like, how did you even come up with this? And he told me basically it was a Greek play, well, Greek book, I think. Yeah, and we went from there.
Have you read the original Lysistrata at all since getting the script?
Not quite, Lee. Not quite. A little bit, but yeah. Not quite.
You get to work with a pretty phenomenal cast. You've got Sam Jackson, Wesley Snipes, Nick Cannon. Just talk about working with actors of that caliber.
Oh, man, it was legendary. Like, Sam, like you said, the one that I was really starstruck, and I'm a huge fan, is Angela Bassett. You know, I thought that was amazing, man. The first time I met her, I hope I didn't freak out enough like that, because I kept looking at it like, wow, I already worked with Angela. Oh, man. But nah, she's just a sweetheart. Like, whatever I thought and could imagine about that woman, she's everything. She's just a sweetheart.
Talk about talk a little bit about shooting in the city of Chicago, you know, because often you don't get to shoot films in the places that they're set. But you guys actually got to shoot in Chicago?
Yes, sir. We shot right in Chicago.
What was that experience like just for you, being in that environment?
It was just the same for me, because like it wasn't my first time being in Chicago. Like, I really know how Chicago is. Chicago is something like Baltimore, you know, but Chicago, the population is much bigger than Baltimore, but it's all the same. It's all the same. I've been coming out here for years.
So speaking of Baltimore, of course, people know you from The Wire, and I can't help look at some of the similarities between the show The Wire and this film Chi-Raq, I guess, in terms of its themes. Was that something that
struck
you as well?
Nah, it's not no similarity. It don't have no similarity to it at all. You know, The Wire, you cannot compare The Wire to Chi-Raq at all. You know? The only thing you can say is the violence. That's about it. But Chi-Raq don't have too much violence in it.
Yeah. What is Spike like as a director?
Oh, man, Spike is a icon. He's a legend. He's brilliant. I mean, there's so many things that I can say about that man. Like, his mind just go beyond. And once his mind go beyond, he bring it to reality. And I think that's what he did with this Chi-Raq movie. Like, who would have tried to shoot a film that they say no peace, No vagina, you know? That's crazy.
You know, he
try to bring it to reality, you know?
Yeah. I know he got into a little bit of trouble recently, or he courted controversy with a couple of things he said in regards to the film, like that he supports the sex strike, which is sort of one of the themes of the film, and also you know, his comments about the violence epidemic on the south side of Chicago. What do you make of those comments?
I don't know what he had said about it or whatever. But what I think about it is, you know, some people, and this before the movie had came out, you know, some people thought he was trying to make fun, I mean, fun of Chicago, and which he was not. You know, it's a movie, so it got to have some type of humor to it to get the audience attention. And, I mean, now that the movie came out, you know, and I've been around a lot of Chicago people, Native people, they'd be like, oh, well, I'm happy that some people be like, there was a musical and, you know, things like that. You know, they saying it. Man, hey, Spike Lee, what can I say? I'm not the writer or the producer of the movie. I'm just in it. So, you know, whatever my opinion is, you know, it's valid, but it's not valid, you know, because I'm not the creator of the movie. I'm just doing my job.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you spent many, many years in Baltimore, and of course, earlier this year, it was the site of many protests. And I actually know, I think I heard that you knew Freddie Gray. Do you have any thoughts not only on that issue, but sort of the whole system wide sort of the larger issue of police brutality and systemic racism?
I mean, it happens. I mean, nowadays, like I said on CNN, you know, like, police brutality, it happens all the time. I'm not saying that all cops are bad, but the ones that is, you know, it happens all the time in your urban community, you know, like, they beat you up, taking money, you know what I mean? And don't lock you up. Keep it moving, things like that, you know. I mean, it's sad to say that, you know, we used to it, you know, but that's life. Now that the camera phones and everything else is out here that's catching them in their act, you know, hopefully it will be justice served because they act like they don't have to answer to nobody because they the law. No, y'all have to answer somebody, you know. When will that happen? I don't know, but, you know, it happens every day. And, yeah, I knew Freddie Gray, you know. Like, we wasn't best friends or nothing like that, but, you know, I see him in a club, passing. Like I said before, Baltimore is really small. So, you know, you're bound to run into anybody, you know.
Yeah, now, I know something that I've read about you that I'm really fascinated in and I'm really interested in is that you're working with, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're working with troubled youth to try and get them into the arts. Do I have that right?
Yes, sir.
How did that start for you, sir? Just given your background and this is something that you wanted to give back sort of thing?
Yeah, I always want to give back. And right now, I'm in the process of putting a foster care together, you know, for foster kids, because, you know, I was adopted, you know, so I know how it feels. I know how it feels not to be loved by the one that you really want, you know what I mean, by your mother and father that you really want to be, that you want to be around, that you want them to love you, you know. So just get back, let them know somebody out here cares. You know, get them a home that they can call home before they go into another home. Hopefully, they don't want to go into another home. They want to stay with me.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah.
What advice would you give to young people?
But stay in school first and foremost, because education, you can't even work at McDonald's without a diploma now, you know.
Yeah.
So stay in school, and if anybody tell you that you can't do something, do it anyway. not to just prove him wrong, but just to prove to yourself that this is my life. You know, this is me. And this is what I want to do. As long as everything is in a positive manner, you can do it. You know?
So Chirac is out now. Do you have any other upcoming projects for the near future?
Yes, I have this project that I just recently did with French Montana. It's called Respect the Shooter. I think that comes out sometime this upcoming year, this year coming up. I got a new book. My first one is called Grace After Midnight. So if you don't have the first one, go get the first one so you can catch up to the second one. And but reality show called Is in the Works. My title for it right now is called Best of Both Worlds. You know, I just got a lot of things, a lot of things that's going on this upcoming year. So.
Well, Chirac is certainly a great movie. It's Spike Lee joined. I encourage everyone to go see it and pick up Grace After Midnight. Felicia Pearson, thank you so much for your time today.
And thanks for having me.
All righty. Have a good one. Ciao.
All right. You too. God bless.
That was Felicia Snoop Pearson, and once again, here's Jill Hennessy with Marsha G.